Accession number 32369, reel 13.
Mr. Cassidy, reel 13. Can we go back to when you landed in Borneo? Where did you land when you came in on the ship?
We landed in the port because we came over on the the landing ship just north of Cote de Belud, and it was we'd been on the ship for a few about 4 or 5 days really, and we were all pleased to get off it. It was exactly a flat-bottom boat, and although the weather was pretty good, the stomach took a bit to get used to it at first, but in the end we all got there, and on the journey over there we'd sank quite a few tins of beer as well for to keep us occupied and all that, but boredom was the main thing going over there. But we managed to form these groups and had a card school, domino school, darts and anything really that was going around, and mainly on the decks there was lots of training still going on around with the weapons, and we managed to get a couple of practices of firing out live ammunition into the sea, so we kept ourselves occupied. And then when we reached our base camp, we disembarked in orderly fashion, and then were set to into a transit camp first of all, and awaited the arrival of the helicopters to take us into our different locations to take over. I think it was the Green Jackets who we took over from first of all.
What was your first impressions on landing at Borneo?
Just the amounts of greenery, where this island, when it first came into view, and everything was green, and we said, well, you know, there must be some habitations somewhere, and we did eventually find it in the transit camp that we went to, but it was tents. And we weren't there very long, but there we were given briefings on how important it was to be on our guard, and the takeover, although the advance party had already gone in to represent each company's where they were going to when we were split up into the locations. So they had already gone ahead and more or less taken over the positions that we would occupy. It was a case of us getting the helicopters and flying in, dropping us off with all our kit, and the Green Jackets waiting there, cheering as soon as the helicopters come, and they jumped on the helicopters out. So it was as quick as that, and obviously that was the term of where we were most prone if there was going to be any attacks or anything like that, it would happen when two units were handing over from each other. So we were there, and it was a case of sorting out duty straight away, and more or less settling into our new mode of life for where we knew we were going to be for the next 6 months.
Did the camp, this first camp, have a name, a title?
I think it was Cote de Belud, where a C company went, and it was occupied first of all by we had a detachment of the Royal Artillery there with their gun, and of course we had the new 81mm mortar there in its position and already dug in, and we really knew what we were in for as soon as we dropped in or got into the camp. We could see where the landing zone was, where the helicopter, where the heli drops were going to be made, and where we would get our rations from when they were dropped by parachute and that.
Were you attached to C Company?
Yes, we were the motor company attached
to C. Can you describe your camp? Was it tented or...?
Well, we had our company commander was Major McBain, and Captain Lawrence was there as well. And the camp itself was on the top of a hill, obviously cleared of all the foliage, and the slit trenches ran in a maze of different areas where you walked along, and they had these wooden slats at the bottom for walking on, and that led to the latrines, the cook house, and all the different areas where the company was sleeping at, and these were a variety of shelters and holes dug in the ground and everything, and made as comfortable as possible. So each day was a case of making it as much homely for yourself as we could. But obviously the duties were varied, and there was a lot of patrols allocated to go out, and we were busy involved with the mortars of finding out where our set targets were, and each night we would fire along with the artillery as well, every night into the set targets, and although we didn't see what was happening, we could hear the end results of where the mortars and where the artillery shells were dropping.
Were you firing off the map, kind of?
Yes, we were firing off the map and had set grid references. Now and again, if there was a patrol out in the jungle, they would ask, which was quite obviously sometimes they did get lost. And we had to be very careful if we got a message back to say that they would like a smoke bomb dropped by the mortars to tell us whereabouts exactly they were, so they could work out a grid reference and know exactly where they were. So we did that on a couple of occasions, and they managed to find out exactly what their position was on the mortars that were dropped there. But it was the daily routine, really, for us as the mortars were concerned, was we would stop in base camp, obviously, and would be on call from either a minute's call for to go into action, then one of the sections would be on half an hour or an hour call up. So depending on what sort of action or what sort of duty you were on, you could either relax a bit in the camp, or you would be on standby waiting for a call or any radio signal to say to bring you into action.
And that would presume if you were in that situation, you'd be with the gun, with the weapon.
Yes, with everything ready just to line up and do on the advice of where the grid reference to the target was, to change the fuses in the mortar bombs and let them go.
And did you ever have any warning of that?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we had quite a few of where reports of Indonesians coming over this side of the border had been received. Whether they were true or false, we don't know. But certainly on two or three occasions, we had a kampong of Indonesians, friendly Indonesians, who lived just below us, below the hill, in their compound where they lived, in these wooden stilted huts that they lived in. And we actually had to set a target to within about 50 yards, or 50 metres of where they were living, so we could bring fire down right within 50 metres of where they were actually at. And and we always thought, well, on some occasions you do get a thing called a drop shot, and those poor people, you know, I mean, friendly forces, if we did happen to have a drop shot, you know, they wouldn't stand much chance. But there was a couple of occasions where we did bring our fire down right to within the safety zone of the of these kampongs as well, and we could actually see the shells exploding through through the foliage. They were that close.
That must have been a pretty shock for these native people.
Well, yes, and whether they got they had been used to it, I don't know. You know, because obviously they'd been there for years and years, and the different regiments who'd been in, well, they would have had probably the same grid references and same targets as what we had. You know, so they probably did get used to it when they heard the first round going up and said, "Well, whether they had shelters to go into or what," I never found out. Never found out.
So presumably the targets were on tracks that the Indonesians would use.
Were using,
so?
Yes. And every now and again, we would change the targets on a night time to just to let them know that we knew the tracks that they were using, and at any one time we could lay down some deadly fire, you know, to keep them away from it. So. But the thing is with mortars, you never do find out if you what sort of damage you've done. But our main concern was really to get the double-checking the grid references and making accuracy at all times, you know. We just couldn't afford to be hasty with anything. But at the same time, we still had to be quick to in case it was our own forces who were under fire, you know. So it was we were on our tours most of the time, and
I suppose that mortars were always in the base camp. You didn't
they were always there. They never went out on patrol mortars because of the obviously the weight and for the base that they needed to operate properly. So the weapon itself was ideal for that sort of terrain anywhere, because of the range now which the 81 millimeter gave, and the trajectory of the bombs when the mortar bombs when they were fired means no position at all was vulnerable. They were all vulnerable from being under attack from a mortar shell. And no, I did talk to quite a few of the patrols who came in when we knew that we'd they'd been quite near to where some of our shells had landed, and that they were quick to admit that it was the most horrible sound they'd ever heard of a mortar shell whizzing through the air, and not knowing when it was where it was going to land, and then hearing the thud when it did land, because of course with the foliage and all that, some of the shells exploded when they came in contact with the trees.
Yeah,
so it was that was the other thing with it. A lot of them did explode where they should have on the ground, but obviously some of them with the sensitive nose cone that they had did explode as they came down in the trees. But it was.
And I think you said that these targets, in effect, would be passed on from unit to unit.
One unit to another, yeah. And then also new ones would be made because, I mean, on intelligence reports that came back, that would dictate whereabouts our patrols were going to go to and whatever. And they obviously used different tracks to get to where their designation was. So a lot of the fixed targets stayed there all the time, but we did get new ones for new to mark up as well. most of the time we knew where the patrols were going out to, what the destination was, so we could pre-fix their more or less patrol the route they were taking, and we would follow them on grid reference map in case we did get a signal that they had been or had made a contact and needed fire brought down quickly. So we were really on our tours whenever the patrols were out to know exactly where they were, so we weren't caught with our socks down wondering with a brand new grid reference. We had an idea whereabouts they were at all times, and obviously Major McBain on the briefings during the day kept us fully informed on the routes of the patrols and what time they were expected to be there and the intelligence reports that they received. So it was a very intense case where people look at it and say, well, the mortars, all you do is put a, you've got a tube and you drop a bomb in and that's it, and it's not. I would say in the 60s then, with the 81mm mortar, the more intricate and accuracy of the weapon came into full force then in supporting the company and the battalion in active service, and it was a really great phase of my life anyway to be a mortar fire controller for Major McBain in active service, and it was really the responsibility then did hit home, and it was something that you passed on to the other people in the group as well.
What rank were you holding at this point in time?
I was then a corporal.
You would have to obviously be careful about foliar trees around you for firing the mortar off. Was it a clear space that you had?
We were in a clear space, yes. Yeah.
There was no danger of
any of the rounds hitting anything on its trajectory upwards. It was when it was coming down where it was in vulnerable for going off. But the one thing where we were was the mortar was always at ready to be fired within seconds, really, as long as the grid references were okay and everything like that. The ammunition was all there primed, ready to be used, and it had to be done every day, and checked, double-checked. So it was the mortar crew, which we had two of them with C Company, two mortars, were kept on the tours training, and also the live firing on the evening, and also we had a chance to watch the Royal Artillery in action as well, because they were just behind us, and they used to fire at roughly the same time as what that we did as well, so it was good. But
how long would this period of fire last?
It would last for about half an hour, really, and depending on, we would vary what sort of ammunition we used, whether it would be high explosive or phosphorus. And I often wonder as well, even to these days, well, when we fired phosphorus, why was the jungle, did it set the jungle on fire or what? We never heard, but we know from previous experience how much damage these mortar shells could do when they landed, So it was, in one way, firing blind and not seeing what the end result was a bit of a anticlimax, but at the same time we knew that they were doing the job that they were there for. And there was also the time where the mortar platoon, we were up to full commitment of three privates who would work as number one, two and three on the mortar itself. And then we had the base controller who was controlling the grid reference, and also the fire controller, which I was for C Company as well. So we also had a couple of privates who were with us who had been trained as mortarmen but were in reserve. They weren't part of the crew. And we obviously said if anyone wanted to go out, because we're all rifle trained in jungle warfare and all that, with one of the patrols, then they could go out subject to permission from the company commander, and act as just to relieve the boredom as such. And quite a few of them did go out, and even
I was thinking your particular duties wouldn't allow you to go out, really.
Well, we had spare people at that time as well, so we wouldn't have sent anybody out if we thought it was like taking any of the key personnel away from the mortar team. So we had things like that. And we also had a spare detachment who would take over from us when we went on R&R, and that's when we knew that halfway through our more or less embankment with C Company, we would get a rest, and we did. We were helicoptered out for, I think it was a week, into a quiet area where we could take our shoes and socks off and jungle green and put a few civilian clothes on and go out to the town and really have a whale of a time for a week and refresh the batteries to get back into the jungle. But it was funny because most of the injuries that we saw in the camp, and it was funny as all that, we seemed to be always wearing flip-flops. And these duck boards that we used to walk on, we would you carried your rifle with you everywhere you went, whether it was at the toilet or you went for a wash. If you went for your cook house, your rifle was with you on your shoulder at all times. And we were grown, or we grew alert to the insects of the jungle. We knew what through in our previous training what sort of animals and insects we could expect to see and all that, and things like fly and snakes. Although we'd never seen them live, we knew that they were around somewhere, and you're always alert looking up and saying, well, if one of these flying snakes does come down, where's it going to land? But the main injury, and especially to myself, was I was always breaking my toenails on these duck boards with these flip-flops, because they used to always seem to catch in the duck board and turn over, and your nail would hit straight on the duck board and your nail would be off. So I had continually had broken toenails through these duck boards and whatever.
Painful?
Yes, very painful and all that, but it was surprising. Now we learned to pick our feet up and try and keep them away from the duck boards. But these plimsolls, although they were very comfortable and nice for the feet and all that, they were a killer when you were walking on them. The other thing, of course, was the communal toilets, which we had to get used to, where we would go on a morning and you'd be getting used to talking to somebody next to you while you were doing your business as such, and then lo and behind, you were holding conversation with about 10 blokes in a line, all sitting down. So that was something that, you know,
How were they constructed?
They were made by the Assault Pioneers, and it was as far, well, not as far as we're sure, we knew that it was the camouflage netting was put round a very large wall, and these thunder boxes, as we called them, were laid out in a line, and all it was a hole in the centre of what you sat on, and then everything went into the deep, and there was a catchment area or something underneath which the locals, I think, looked after and drew them out every now and again from the other side, and that was it. But I think on most occasions it was a case of, well, you go to the toilet, you do your business and you come back, because obviously, one, the smell wasn't very good, although a lot of disinfectant and everything like that was used to try and hide the smell of it, but it never went away, especially in the humid jungle weather as well. Everything, all the smells you could smell, but it was a case of you got used to it after time. But it was uncomfortable, but not in a way that you wouldn't go, because obviously if you had to go, you had to go, and that was it.
Did it attract the flies?
Yes, there was always flies around and insects and whatever. So with the flies, you got used to them, and mosquitoes were the worst things that we didn't like, because they would leave the mark on you, and if you started scratching them, you ended up with red blotches all over the place, But
did they give you anything for that, you know, to put on mosquito bite?
Yeah, we had mosquito repellent and stuff like that, although I think some of the times the mosquitoes must have been it didn't stop them. I mean, they still bit you. The other thing was that a lot of the patrols, when they came back in, suffered leeches. Mm. And even though we all had jungle boots, and they had jungle boots when they went out, these leeches could get through the eye hole of a needle, and the amount of blood they sucked was unbelievable. So they even had nicknames for some of the places where they did their patrols, and one of them was called Leech Hill. And it was a well-known place where they used to bivouac down for the night. And no matter how many precautions they took, they always still got leeches on them by the next morning. And we were always keen, when the patrols come back, obviously they were debriefed every time they came back by Major McVean and the other officers. But we used to always mix with them and ask them different things on what it was like and what they came across and how it was and whatever. And I wouldn't say there was any animosity between the rifle platoons and the mortar section, because we didn't actually go out on patrol anywhere. But we were always keen and said, well, you know, we wouldn't mind going out as well, but we kind of go out. And I said, you wouldn't manage anyway. If you got out, you wouldn't know what to do. And we used to turn around and said, well, if you were left to look after this, you wouldn't know what to do either. So it was tit for tat.
Did you have to take anything for malaria?
Tablets. We took the main cause of thing was, and we were always stuck on it, was the water. And we all had water purification tablets, but we knew that every time we had a drink of water, wherever it was, we should use the water purification tablets to make sure it was all right. But it left a bitter taste to the water itself, even though it cleared it. We knew it cleared it, or supposed to have cleared it. It didn't taste as good when we put the tablets in, but we got around it and whatever. And I don't think we had any cases of malaria, although we had different diseases of the normal ones, flu and prickly heat was the main one thing out there, where a lot of the people were going down with.
That's caused by sweat.
Sweat, yes.
Sweating.
And it was very... I had a mild case of it, just a mild case, but it was very uncomfortable as such. And apart from that, now inhabitants who joined us when we in our living accommodation was the rats, and I hated them, because the rats were as big as cats, and they came out at night time, especially just after we had no doubts that we're in. And all we could hear was these rats running around, and at times you could feel them running over you as well. And on numerous occasions, although we had traps and all kinds of things, the rats were that big, they used to run away with the traps on them. That never killed them, and we used to just try have sticks and all kinds to get rid of them, but they were always there.